Okay, we are starting chapter 2 tonight. So we are in, that means that we're in week 3 in the workbook. It starts on page 19. The questions start on page 20. You'll recall chapter 1, the way Daniel organized that chapter, it appears he organized it around the phrase, God gave. Chapter 1 divides up into 3 sections, and near the beginning of each section is that phrase. That verses 1 through 7 is the first section, and at the beginning of it, Daniel says, God gave Jehoiakim and the temple into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. Then the next section in Daniel 1 is 8 through 16. And in verse 9, we're told that God gave Daniel favor with the chief of the eunuchs and by extension, the steward. And then in verses 17 through 21, the final section, when he's tested by Nebuchadnezzar, when the 4 are tested by Nebuchadnezzar, we're told that God gave them the ability to master all that Babylonian literature and whatnot. And they were 10 times better than all of the wise men. So he structured that whole first chapter around that phrase, God gave. And we said that implied that God was present with them throughout, all the way from the siege of Jerusalem through the 3-year, the deportation and 3-year testing of those 4 youths. God was with them and causing them to flourish and all that. Now, in chapter 2, you don't see it. Unless you got the King James or something like that, you won't see it. But at the beginning of chapter 2, verse 1, chapter 2, there in the Hebrew, there is a conjunction. And it actually starts out in the Hebrew. It actually starts out, and in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. It's not a big deal, but here's what it implies. That conjunction and implies that chapter 2 flows out of chapter 1. And what we see in chapter 2 is what was implicit in chapter 1, God's presence and sovereign control and care that was implied in chapter 1 by that threefold use of the phrase God gave. So that was implied, his presence and sovereign care was implied in chapter 1. It becomes explicit in chapter 2. And all throughout chapter 2, but you can see it in particular, the very center of chapter 2, verses 20 through 23, where Daniel breaks out and prays to God when Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and might and have now made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's matter. But we'll see all throughout the chapter 2, it's explicit. It is explicitly expressed that God is there and in sovereign control. He's the one that rules over rulers. Okay? So, and as a matter of fact, what we're going to see is that's the way it is in chapters 2 through 6. All the rest of those historical narrative chapters, remember the first six chapters are historical narrative. Daniel's just sharing historical highlights from his roughly 70 years in the courts of Babylonian and Persian rulers. And so it's just interesting the way he set that up. It's implied in chapter 1, God's presence and sovereign care, and it becomes explicit in chapters 2 through 6. Because remember, in chapter 2, it's that vision of fourfold kingdoms followed by the kingdom of God, the eternal kingdom. Then comes God protecting Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from this powerful ruler in the, you know, protecting them in the fiery furnace. Then in chapter 4, he's going to humble Nebuchadnezzar. Then in chapter 5, he's going to humble Belshazzar. And then in chapter 6, he's protecting Daniel in the lion's den from malicious, scheming, evil government officials. So it's implied in chapter 1, and then in chapters 2 through 6, it gets up close and personal for these Babylonian rulers and Babylonian and Persian rulers. God is the one who rules over rulers. He is present with his people, and he sovereignly cares for them and sovereignly humbles and brings down and raises up rulers. Okay? So anyway, just thought you'd like to know what a word that's not there implies. That's a joke. Anyway, so we'll start at the top of page 20. What I want to do is, instead of just reading all 49 verses at the beginning, I'll read the verses for each section that we address, one section at a time. And so, let me read the first 13 verses of chapter 2. And in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. Then the king commanded that the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans be summoned to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king. And the king said to them, I had a dream, and my spirit is troubled to know the dream. And you can imagine the Chaldeans are standing there thinking, and? But the and didn't come. So in verse 4, then the Chaldeans said to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the word from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you shall, literally in the Hebrew, become body parts. You shall be torn limb from limb, and your houses shall be laid in ruins. But if you show the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and its interpretation. They answered a second time and said, let the king tell his servants the dream and we will show its interpretation. The king answered and said, I know with certainty that you are trying to gain time, because you see that the word for me is firm. If you do not make the dream known to me, there is but one sentence for you. You have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the time changes. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me its interpretation. The Chaldeans answered the king and said, there is not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand. They probably said a little more reverential. There's not a man on earth that can tell. I lost my place now. On earth who can meet the king's demand, for no great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. The thing that the king asks is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. Because of this, the king was angry and very furious, and commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed. So the decree went out, and the wise men were about to be killed, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. Okay. The author writes, verse 1 tells us that Nebuchadnezzar was deeply troubled by his dreams. Why do you suppose that was? In the ancient world, dreams were viewed as communication from the gods and thus thought to anticipate the future. How does understanding this shed light on Nebuchadnezzar's response? So first of all, two questions he's asking there. Just reading these first 13 verses. Why do you suppose Nebuchadnezzar was deeply troubled by his dreams? Nick. Right. Yeah, so he answered both of them. He said because he didn't understand the dream. That's why it was troubling to him. And the fact that they viewed dreams as God's letting the king, giving the king a glimpse into the future, made it even all the more troubling. That's certainly right. Anything else? Anybody else have anything else written down? Just because he didn't know it, why would it be troubling? Nerupa. Yeah. So a scary dream, huh? Yeah, a scary dream. Yeah, very good. Excellent. Yeah, scary dream. So you get a scary dream, and you don't know what it means, and you think it might hold a glimpse for the future, you would be troubled, right? And then we see that verses 29 through 35 confirms that. We weren't supposed to answer the question with those verses in mind, but I still read ahead. In verse 29, Daniel told the king, as you lay in bed, came thoughts of what would be after this. Now there's debates about what does he mean by after this. Distant future, near future, probably both. Anyway, but definitely after Nebuchadnezzar. And he who reveals mysteries made known to you what it is to be. So Nebuchadnezzar went to bed, fell asleep, thinking about what's going to come after him, right? And then Daniel, in verses 31 through 35, describes the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. And as we see at the end there, it ends in a catastrophe, doesn't it? And so knowing that they believed, the ancients believed, that God gave dreams to, in particular to kings, as a glimpse into the future about what's going to happen. And what happens to the king happens to the nation, right? They're kind of connected. So that would explain what about Nebuchadnezzar's response? That's the second question. How does knowing all of that help understand Nebuchadnezzar's response? And by that, I'm assuming he's referring to the Chaldeans, the magicians, the astrologers, the wise men, Nebuchadnezzar's response to them, summoning them and making his demands. How does that? You understand what I'm asking? So first of all, the answer to that first question is, like Nick said, Nick and Nehrupa said, he got a scary dream and he didn't understand it. So he wants to understand it. The answer to the second question, you have to understand, in Nebuchadnezzar's mind, he's thinking this is a signal from the gods of what's going to happen. And what's going to happen is a catastrophe. And he doesn't understand it. So he wants to understand, what is this catastrophe that the gods are giving him a glimpse of? So that's his mindset. He's trembling as he's buttoning up his PJs and calling in the wise men. So how does that background explain the way he approached the wise men and the demand that he made of the wise men? I think that's what question number two is. Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly right. If they truly have a connection with the gods, they should know it. They should know the dream. And what else? What else? What is he concerned about, what he gets from the wise men? That they're fake. Yeah, they're just making it up. This is a scary dream. It's a glimpse of a catastrophe that's going to befall him and his nation. He has no idea what it means. Who's the guy with the golden face, you know, and the iron legs, you know, who is that? So he wants to ensure that what he gets from the wise men is right, is accurate. So it is, as his wise men say, as the Chaldeans say, that's unreasonable and it's impossible. But you can understand where he's coming from. Also, I think there's God in the background there just stirring this up in him. So anyway, anybody put anything else down as answered in answering that question? Well, what I was saying is God was probably particularly agitating his heart about this dream that he had, not letting him forget it, and really pricking his mind and conscience about the implication of this. What does this mean? Stirring him up about that, yeah. One commentator wrote, one of the takeaways from this is, when tyrants suffer from bad dreams, God is at work. I like that. I thought that was pretty cute. So then the next set of questions here, the author says, Nebuchadnezzar called together a group of people who were trained to interpret dreams. The magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans. Chaldeans originally were ethnically Babylonians. Scholars will debate about what all is meant by Chaldeans. But typically you can just think Babylonians. But also, it was also used, and we can see it's used here in Daniel this way, to refer to all of the wise men, the magicians, the astrologers, and whatnot. So just think Chaldeans, Babylonian wise men, magicians, and astrologers, okay? Anyway, what was unusual about Nebuchadnezzar's request? How did the Chaldeans respond? Again, two questions. First of all, what was unusual about Nebuchadnezzar's request? Yeah. The test, like Pam said, the test that he threw out to them was unusual. You tell me the dream. When's the last time your spouse or your child got up in the morning and said, I had a dream, can you tell me what it is? So that was a bit unusual. How did the Chaldeans respond? They failed the test, and in particular, Pat's over there doing the Three Stooges. and what in particular did they tell him about his request? That's right. It's unreasonable. It's impossible. No man, only the gods. And then what did they go on to say? And the gods don't dwell with flesh. Yeah, exactly. And verses 10 and 11. Do you find anything ironic about that? What did you find ironic about that? They just said, who doesn't? Or at least doesn't dwell with them, right? But what about the God of Israel? Yes, the true and living God actually does dwell among flesh, doesn't he? Garden of Eden, the temple, so on and so forth. He was present with the nation. And then what happened? Not only does he dwell with them, not only does he dwell with flesh, but he became flesh. Exactly. John 1:14 says that that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us.
I was just thinking of just a clarification. They believe that their dreams
Yeah, I don't know how all of that how all of that works out in their thought, but essentially what they were telling Nebuchadnezzar, you're talking to humans. And remember, the pagan deities were in large part distant and aloof from the people. They didn't have access to them. Okay? Ask the prophets of Baal. They tried all kinds of things to try to rouse Baal. Remember that? And then Elijah started mocking them. Maybe Baal's asleep. But they in large part don't have access to the gods, and the gods are aloof and all of that. It's a one-way street. The gods can contact them, send them a dream or something like that, but they don't have access to the gods. And that's how the God of Israel, actually the true and living God, is distinguished from all of these false gods. He does dwell. As a matter of fact, that's why he made man, is men and women. That's why he made humans, is to dwell with them. Not only did he become flesh, but then what else can we say? Look at John, say, 14:27. Sure, go ahead.
Peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you. Not as the world gives, do I give to you. Not let your heart be troubled, nor let it be fearful.
Is that 14:27?
Yes.
Did I write down the wrong? 26, try 26.
With the helper of the Holy Spirit, that one. And the Father will send in my name.
Try 20 and 21. let me the verse that says Christ will be in you.
And that day you will know that I am in my Father, and you in me, and I in you.
Yes. 20. Okay. Why I wrote down, I know why I wrote down 27. I was conflating John 14:20 and Colossians 1:27. Look at Colossians 1:27. You just had it to figure out. That's right. Let's call in the Chaldeans and see if they can figure that mystery out. Look at Colossians 1:27. Read the whole verse.
To whom God will to make known what is the riches of the glory of his mystery.
And that's all there is in that verse.
Among his house, which is Christ in you, the whole glory.
Bingo. She was just sure I was had the wrong verse again. Yeah. And it was at the end of the verse. Yeah, really. So not only does the God of Israel dwell with flesh, but he actually became flesh, and now he dwells in us. So as the author says later, the gospel totally overturns what the Chaldeans said in verses 10 and 11. The gospel completely overturns that. Yes, the living and true God does dwell with flesh. He became flesh, and now he dwells in his people. All right. Now, anybody have anything else they had written down in those questions? Yes, no, maybe so. All righty. Then let's read the verses 14 through 24. Daniel goes on. He says, "Then Daniel replied with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He declared to Arioch, the king's captain, 'Why is the decree of the king so urgent?' Then Arioch made the matter known to Daniel. And Daniel went in and requested the king to appoint him a time that he might show the interpretation to the king. Then Daniel went to his house and made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, and told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, 'Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and might and have now made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's matter.' Therefore, Daniel went into Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus to him, 'Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the kingdom, before the king, and I will show the king the interpretation.'" Okay. So, the author says, regarding this section, the author says, Daniel requests an audience with Nebuchadnezzar to interpret his dream. Why, in the flow of events in this passage, is this such a bold and faith-filled thing for Daniel to do? What do you think? Yep, that's for sure. That's for sure. In addition to telling the king that your kingdom's going to be toppled. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Anything else occur to you? Just think of the bullet items of what happened here. Nerupa. Bingo. Yes. Yes. Yes, excellent. Nerupa said he didn't know the dream. He didn't know the interpretation. But he went ahead and made an appointment with the king to tell him both. Yes, and he went into a furious king. There's one other thing that I saw. Very first thing that happens. Yes.
Could this be one thing like Daniel,
Right.
Be in contact with God, but then here's this kid, like, who are you?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, I mean, he's just newly graduated Babylon University of wise guys, and because I don't know if you noticed this, but how long was his training? How long in chapter one? How long were their training? 3 years. And chapter two puts this. This story in chapter 2, in what year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign? Second year. Wait a minute. Nebuchadnezzar is the one that besieged Jerusalem and took them, deported them to Babylon. And they 3 years in training. And now Daniel is in the court. This event happens. Here's how it works. In Babylon, in Babylonia, and I think also Persia as well, when they give you the years of the reign of a king, they don't start with his accession year. That is, the year that he becomes king, they don't count that as year one. It's the first year after the year that he became king. So in the first year that he became king, he Daniel and his three friends began their three-year training. In their second year of training, that was Nebuchadnezzar's official first year. And so in their third year of training, that was Nebuchadnezzar's official second year. So Nebuchadnezzar's been on the job for 3 years. Accession year, year one, year two. Okay? It's just a funny way of... And I think what it is they just don't count partial years. It's the first full calendar year after you become king that they count as year one of your reign. Does that make sense? Right, right, exactly. And... yeah. A president gets elected in November, and it's not exactly analogous, but I was elected in 1980, but his presidency didn't start until 1981, right? So there's examples we could go, but that's, I don't know if anybody noticed that, but anyway... So, yeah, the other thing that I saw in this chain of events here is what's the first thing that Daniel did? Asked who? The executioner. This is the guy, Arioch was the guy that was tasked with the job of killing the wise men. Yeah, what a job. And so Daniel approaches the chief executioner. What's up? What's going on? So he approaches the chief executioner. He approaches the king when the king is violently angry. He commits himself to answer the king's demand, even though he has no idea of the dream and its interpretation. He's staking his very life on the mercy of God. Right? Because that's when, so after he did that, after he approached the chief executioner and said, "What's up, man?" And then he went in before this violently enraged king and committed himself to meeting the king's demand. The next thing he did was ran home and told Shadrach, Meshach, and told Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Here I am putting them into Babylonian culture, aren't I?" He tells them, "Quick, seek the mercy of the God of heaven." So that's why it's such a bold and faith-filled thing for Daniel to do. He's literally staking his very life on the mercy of God. But he had to first face the executioner and the angry king in order to buy the time to seek the mercy of God. So then, at the top of page 21, the author writes, after God reveals the dream to Daniel, he praises God as the one to whom belong wisdom and might. But he also goes on to praise God for giving him this same wisdom and might in verse 23. You see that? Look in those verses. 20, Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might." And then down in 23, "To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and might." In this context, the author asks, what does it mean for God to have wisdom and might and then give it to Daniel? Do you have any thoughts that you jotted down there? Yeah, that's the way God gave him his wisdom, isn't it? Gave him the knowledge of the meaning of what the dream is and the meaning of that dream. Daniel knew that that was in the wisdom of God, but he didn't know it. That was part of the wisdom of God, what God showed Nebuchadnezzar in his dream. And so by giving that to Daniel, he gave Daniel some of his wisdom. What about might? Might or power? Sure, yeah, I can see that, where he'll go into before Nebuchadnezzar confident and all of that. What else? What else is powerful about that encounter with Nebuchadnezzar? Where he's going to go in and share the dream and its interpretation. What's that going to do to Nebuchadnezzar? He's going to find out some bad news. But it gives Daniel influence over the king, right? So he goes in there with this confidence, and it's going to influence the king. So that's probably what he means. It's a little less clear what he means about being given his might, but I think the confidence and the influence that this wisdom is going to have on the king. And in point of fact, we see that's exactly what turned out. Daniel got promoted second in command. So You can think of the gift of wisdom being the revelation of the mystery, the understanding of the dream and its meaning. And the gift of might probably is not only the confidence he has, but the influence that it's going to have on the king. It's a powerful moment when Daniel walks in there and shares what the dream is and what it means. That's why you see this king just fall flat on his face. He's overwhelmed. It's a powerful moment. Yeah, and that's even more impressive. He's what, 18 years old? And Nebuchadnezzar will probably remember him when Daniel goes in and starts. He goes, oh yeah, he's one of those four dudes that are 10 times better than all the other Chaldeans. So that would be impressive to him. And so I think it's referring to the moment being so powerful, Daniel in exercising its influence to him, because it's an incredible thing for him to go in there and say, this was your dream, and here's what it means. The other thing I want to point out here is verses 20 to 23 here is the very center. The way Daniel structured chapter 2, this is the very center of it. Notice the story. I mean, what happens goes very quickly. Daniel doesn't share a whole lot of details. It's just bullet items. I went up to Arioch. He told me what was going on. I went in before the king, got an appointment, went home, told my friends, and we prayed, and God gave us the answer. And it's pretty much just like that. That fast moving and that sparse as far as detail goes. But then he erupts in verses 20 to 23 with this praise to God for what God did. And so the way you can look at it is that verses 20 to 23 kind of summarizes what happened in those first 19 verses and anticipates what's going to happen in the rest of the chapter, verses 24 through 49. So that this praise is just right in the way he's structured is just right in the center of the chapter. It summarizes what happened, and it tells us what's going to happen in the rest of the chapter. God gave him wisdom and power. And that's exactly what we see. He marches right into the throne room, tells the king what his dream is, what it means. The king falls on his face, not because he tripped on his robe, because he was overwhelmed with what Daniel just did, and he elevates him to the second in command. And then at Daniel's request, his three friends are elevated as well. So, anyway, probably only have, I don't know if we have time to go through that third section. Pardon?
Seven.
Oh, Revelation? Daniel? Oh, you talk Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7?
Yeah.
The dream that he gave Nebuchadnezzar is four kingdoms followed by an eternal kingdom. And the same thing in Daniel 7. The beasts, the sequence of beasts that he shows Daniel in a vision is the sequence of four kingdoms followed by an eternal kingdom. Yeah. Yep. So then we probably don't have nine. We only got 5 minutes left, so we'll stop there. But as far as this issue that Daniel's praising God over, this issue of revealing mysteries. Now, when he talks about mystery, you notice over on page 25 at the bottom. That's where he has his footnotes. I don't know if you notice as you're reading through this chapter in the workbook, he has three footnotes, a one, a two, a three, that you can go to the end of the chapter here, and the footnotes are there, and they're definitions. So look, he doesn't have mystery. That scoundrel. I thought he did. Oh, that's why. Yes, that's where it's at. Whole Bible connections on page 23. Mystery. In Daniel 2, God stands forth as the revealer of mysteries. In Daniel, as well as the rest of the Bible, the word mystery is not intended to refer to something cryptic or clandestine. You know, this we're not talking about a Poirot episode, okay? Rather, it refers to what God has yet to disclose about his purposes for the world. It's a mystery because it's undisclosed. It's God's plan. He's got everything planned out, but he hasn't revealed everything. So what he has not revealed to us is a mystery to us, okay? So he's not talking about something cryptic or clandestine. He's talking about something undisclosed, unrevealed. So what's interesting here is in chapter 2, this issue of revealing mysteries, of seeing into the dark, stuff that's not revealed, stuff that's undisclosed, is a central theme in this chapter. And you can already see that because Nebuchadnezzar's already upset. He's making unreasonable demands. God gives Daniel understanding of the mystery. So now it's no longer a mystery because now it's been revealed. It's been disclosed to Daniel, and Daniel's going to disclose it to the king. But another way that you can tell that that this whole issue of revealing mysteries is a controlling theme in this chapter is that words, Hebrew and Aramaic words for reveal, show, make known, and tell are used 31 times in this chapter. That's a lot in 49 verses. Those kind of verbs are used 31 times. 31 times it's talking about making it known, showing, telling, revealing. This is a controlling theme. And this is what is behind Daniel's praise. God has revealed this mystery. And Daniel knows that God has told the king, has disclosed to the king something of what's going to happen in the future. What does it remind you of? Can you think of any other biblical events that it reminds you of? I'm talking about God disclosing his plans for the future to a king. Alex. Yep, Pharaoh in Egypt. Joseph, remember? Joseph told him the same thing. God's the one that reveals this. God has told you what's going to happen. And that's exactly what Daniel tells Nebuchadnezzar here. Okay, so for next week, let's work on finishing up this chapter. So that's section 3 on 21, section 4 on 22, and then read through pages 22 and 23 and 24, and then answer those four questions on pages 24 and 25. That will be homework for next Sunday evening. Okay. Aren't you glad we have a God that is in control? He makes wise and good plans, and he tells his friends. That's what Jesus said in John 15. I'm telling you what's happening because you're my friend. I tell my friends. That's an amazing concept, isn't it?